Carcass transfer, in the most easiest of terms, would be the pounds of live game that are actually ending up on the carcass. So pounds of live game that are making their way onto the carcass of that animal. So in a time like right now, where we are drastically being paid for additional pounds of beef, we see historically high cattle prices. And just for, you know, today's sake, I actually pulled the National Weekly Cattle and Beef Summary for the week of May 6th. And so obviously a few days ago, live steers were coming in at $185.74 and dressed steers were at $294.65 per hundredweight. So we are seeing, like, it's crazy how valuable each additional pound of gain is.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Give your cattle platinum protection with Virbac Bovagen Platinum Vaccines. Start your protection at us.virbac.com/platinum protection. Data shows most cattle don't get enough vitamin D, which can impact health and performance. High D from DSM Firmenich can help improve cattle's vitamin D status. Be proactive with Cattle Active. Visit proearthanimalhealth.com today. Lalamond Animal Nutrition offers microbial solutions to boost animal welfare and performance.
Welcome to the Beef Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Brandy Buzzard, and it's my pleasure to bring you the trending issues and topics with the best and brightest minds in the beef industry. Today, we are joined by Dr. Jessica Sperber. Dr. Sperber earned her master's in meat science from West Texas A&M University and her PhD in ruminant nutrition from the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. She is currently an assistant professor and feedlot extension specialist at UNL and focuses on the relationship between feeder cattle performance and carcass outcomes, in addition to several other things. We're going to talk all things feedlot today, so buckle up. Welcome to the pod, Dr. Sperber.
Thanks for having me, Brandy.
We are excited to jump right in. To start off with, just like, what can you tell us about how you got involved in the beef industry, kind of your career path so far and your background? I know that there's a lot more below the surface than the like two sentences that I read. So just, you know, fill us in, please.
Yeah. So I grew up, my family has a cow-calf and grain operation in central Alberta. So I grew up in the 4-H beef industry, showing cattle, you know, doing carcass competitions, lots of interest in the live side of things. But what truly got me interested in meat science was actually, I was a cattleman's young leader in 2016, 2017 for the Canadian Cattle Association. And during the interview process for the Cattleman's Young Leader Mentorship, I actually was recommended to Ty Lawrence at West Texas A&M. So prior to that, I had no experience with meat science. I mean, I had never been in a large packing plant at that point in time, just, you know, small abattoir, but got a phone call from Dr. Ty Lawrence and ended up pursuing my master's degree there, where I worked on carcass cloning and had a live to dead study. So that was probably, you know, my interest in, you know, tied my interest in well with live cattle all the way through harvest, which really sparked a lot of my interest in the packing industry and what cattle look like on the rail and just how important it is what we're doing in terms of feedlot management and nutrition on what ends up on the rail at the packing plant at the end of the day. And so after finishing my master's, I kind of had more of an interest back in the live side of things, wanted to get some feedlot experience growing up cow-calf, master's in meats. And then obviously there was one missing piece of the puzzle in the beef sector, and that was the feedlot industry. So came to work with Dr. Galen Erickson at UNL, pursued my PhD in feedlot nutrition. Graduated from that in December of 2021, and I actually went back to Canada. My parents were pretty adamant that I went back, tried out just a little bit, see if I could handle the cold still. And so I moved back north for about 9 months. That's all it took for me to then come back south. And so I actually worked up there for a feed company doing technical service and support for their sales team in terms of ruminant nutrition and mainly in the feedlot side of things. And then this position got created at UNL, the feedlot extension specialist role. So I'm here, large extension appointment, do a little bit of commercial research. And then in addition, I have a 30% teaching appointment. So I'm fortunate to get to work with undergrad and graduate students on feedlot management related topics. So it's been a whirlwind over my 30 years. I just had my 30th birthday. So it's been a whirlwind, but it's been excellent. And I've been very fortunate to literally pair every sector of the industry together to understand the entire beef value chain.
That's great. Yeah, you do have a wide variety of experiences there. And you did go from one climate, like I was just thinking, you said if you could still handle the cold, you went from like one extreme to the other, back and forth there a couple times. So, well, let's just jump right in when it comes to cattle feeding. You already said that you grew up in the beef industry and agriculture in Canada. And while there's strong similarities between agriculture in Canada and the United States, I have to imagine there are some differences too. So, I mean, can you fill us in on how cattle feeding in Canada differs from cattle feeding in the United States?
Yeah, so I think, Brandy, you mentioned it, right? There's a lot of similarities. I would say that, you know, we definitely are the most two similar countries when it comes to beef production and the way that we raise our animals. In terms of the feedlot sector, I would say the biggest thing that, you know, was different for me transitioning from Nebraska back to Alberta was obviously the feedstuff availability. And so coming from Nebraska, we have a large opportunity to include byproduct in the diet, right? Just in the form of distiller grains and wet corn gluten feed as a byproduct of the ethanol industry. We didn't really have a lot of opportunity for that in Alberta. There was a few feed yards that if they could get their hands on distiller's grains, they were shipping it up there. But to the extent that we included in the diet in Nebraska, really, the Alberta diet was completely different. And then in addition, for their concentrator, their grain, it's largely is barley. And so barley prices have increased as of late. And so they are seeing more corn being brought into the province of Alberta. So those diets are changing now. But in terms of a true grain, I mean, corn and barley are different in terms of energy and protein. And so that was a big learning curve for me, going from always creating all of my rations in the States in terms of corn-based with byproduct addition, and then moving back home to, you know, utilizing barley and canola meal, which is very, you know, a very different blend, but ultimately getting us the same gains and performance improvements. You know, then when we talk about weather, I don't like the cold weather that much. And, you know, there are weather challenges. Yes, there are weather challenges in Nebraska, and especially in, you know, southeast Nebraska, where we have our university feedlot in terms of mud management, right? But right. In Alberta, you know, the cold snap lasts for a lot longer, and the use of different implementation strategies to reduce the impact, negative impacts of cold on those cattle is needed. So in terms of windbreakers or bedding, we do a lot of bedding. You know, that could be a straw, barley straw, wheat straw, et cetera. Not a lot of corn stalks being used as bedding up there, but a little bit.
Those are being used for something else.
Yeah, exactly. And so I would say probably the diet and just environmental challenges. But in terms of, you know, implant, beta agonist use technologies, very, very similar across the board. Mm-hmm. Obviously now as we've moved into our new, you know, the new world of implants in the States, where we can only give one implant, if not, you know, on label for a re-implant system in each phase of production. In the US, Canada doesn't have that in their realm yet. So they still have the opportunity to use, you know, re-implant strategies in every phase of, in the feedlot phase of production. Whereas obviously we are more limited in terms of implant use in the States now.
So is Alberta the primary where most cattle feeding in Canada happens? Is that where most of that happens?
Yes. To my knowledge, it's over 40%.
Okay. Gotcha.
Cattle on feed. So there's a lot of cattle on feed in Alberta.
Yeah. I have
predominantly, it would be central to southern Alberta. There are still, like, I mean, there's a few yards in northern central Alberta, but the majority of cattle feeding is in southern Alberta. We call it Feedlot Alley.
Yeah. Oh, that makes sense. And then I have another question about the barley. So similar. So like, obviously, this will not be a surprise for you. This is for the audience. So there's a flavor difference between grass-finished beef and grain-finished beef. And so, you know, regardless of what we all prefer, I don't think that anybody can deny that there's a different flavor profile. And so calling on your meat science here, what kind of, are there any flavor profile differences between like the diet where it's primarily barley and primarily corn? Like, is that something that's noticeable? Cause I don't know that I can say that I've ever had like a whole muscle cut of beef from Canada. The last time I was in Canada, I was there for my husband's company that he works for is based in Quebec. And so in Montreal. And so he works in the swine industry. So we ate pork. So I don't think I've ever had, you know, Canadian whole muscle cut beef. So I don't know. Is there, you tell me, or maybe there isn't, you know, just is there a difference in flavor between those two?
Yeah. So interestingly enough, it depends on what side of the border you're on, because Americans will always say, oh, it's not corn fed beef. It's just not, you know, it's always a competition. It's not corn fed beef. We notice a difference. And then Canadians will always say, well, you can tell it's not barley fed beef. To me, probably the only real difference would be a little bit of a texture change, maybe a little bit of a little bit of a flavor profile in terms of, I would say, a little bit corn raised beef, and this is not a meat science term, but more sweet and a little bit more sweet in the flavor, whereas it's a little bit more beefy on barley fed. But I mean, that changes drastically based on ration type and cattle type and location that they're being fed. So to me personally, I just think beef is beef, especially when it's raised conventionally like we have in Canada and the US. But if you get on either side of the border, they'll always try and sway you one way or the other.
I'm going to Canada in the fall, and so I'm going to make it a point to try to make sure to have some beef and see if there's I doubt I'll be able to taste anything. But I just want to try it.
Well, you know, Brandy, though, it'll be labeled different though, right? So although the quality grade standards are almost identical in the two countries, it's labeled different. We don't have standard, select, choice, and prime. We have AA, AAA, and prime. So okay. It's the A system, which is ironic, because a lot of people say, oh, you're Canadian A. And it's like, yeah, well, even our grading system is an A.
So is triple A the best?
No, prime.
So it's prime, and then
triple A would be equivalent to choice.
Okay. Gotcha. Yeah. Because I was thinking in sports phrases that like triple A baseball is not very good. So that's where my brain went. Or, you know, triple A baseball isn't as good as, like, you know what I mean, as like the big leagues. And so my brain was backward there. So I'm sorry. I'm a Royals and Chiefs fan, and the Royals are actually doing well right now. So my brain was in baseball from listening to that this morning. So, well, that's really interesting to hear, like, just the differences there. I mean, I think that somewhere I heard that, you know, there's 1,000 ways to raise cattle. And so it's just, and to achieve the same, you know, the same goal. And so it's just, I find it very intriguing to see the differences between production systems, nutritional plans, things like that. I find that really interesting. So, you know, I just, thank you. I found that very intriguing. So in feedlots, I know that this is something that you're passionate about and that we talked, that, you know, we said we're going to get to. And so not all feeder cattle are created equally. I think that, you know, you specializing in feedlot cattle know that very well. How do you manage heifers differently than steers in a feedlot, for those of our listening audience who are not well-versed in feedlots? Is that something you could touch on a little bit?
Of course. So, you know, I think it's important to start with where we usually are in terms of heifer numbers and cattle on feed, right? So on any given year, heifer numbers or heifer on feed is anywhere from 37% to 38%. So total cattle on feed, heifers take up about 37% to 38% of that. Because of the extreme tightening of our cow herd that we've gone through for the last 4 years now, or 3 years, I guess, because we're down since 2020, about 10% of the beef cow population, we were seeing a lot more heifers making their way into the feedlot system. And this is just because we weren't keeping them as replacement females for breeding, and they were going into the feedlot. And so, you know, January 1 numbers, we were, you know, sitting pretty high up at nearly about 40% of heifers on feed, which is up quite a bit, right? That 2.5% is a lot of animals when you look at the broad scale of the U.S. beef industry. However, the April 1 cattle on feed report, and this was reported by Dr. Daryl Peel out of Oklahoma State, he actually mentioned that it's down to 38.5% total cattle on feed. So this might be an inkling that we are retaining more females into the cow herd. So we might be in that rebuilding phase. Just for reference, when, you know, we had the bad drought in 2013, 2014, and heifer numbers in the feedlot increased and, you know, cow numbers decreased, that number got all the way down to 34% of total cattle on feed 34% heifers of total cattle on feed in the feedlot in order to build back up the cow herd. So, you know, 38.5% is a long way from the 34% for the rebuilding. Yeah. So we still do, you know, we have a lot of heifers in the feedlot. Obviously, the biggest challenge and the difference is the cycling of those females, right? And so when we think about how we're going to manage the estrus cycle in those animals, very different than what we have to do in terms of steers who no longer have those intact parts. And so, you know, our biggest comment to producers always, and maybe guys who are just getting into feeding heifers, is you got to make sure pregnancy check, make sure that those females are not coming in pregnant. So that can be done obviously multitude of ways, rectal palpation, blood tests, ultrasound. And so as soon as you know that they're either not pregnant or pregnant, now you can move forward with knowing what you're going to do with those females. So if they are pregnant, maybe you remove them from the feeding group. And, or if they are pregnant, maybe you use an abort officiant. That obviously has to be a conversation with your veterinarian in terms of use. A lot of people aren't aware, but abort officiants, the dose will change based on the age and the weight of the heifer. And so it's important to, you know, discuss those with your veterinarian and what's appropriate for the group of cattle that you're looking to feed. In terms of, I did have an interesting conversation with a producer one time. Well, my, I know that a few in that pen are bred, but she's not going to calve, be anywhere near calving by the time I ship her to the packer. And the thing is that when you send a intact pregnant female to the packing plant, to number one, her final, you better sell her live is all I'm going to say, is because the final body weight and the dress is going to reduce drastically because of mass amount of weight that's, you know, with the fetus and growing that fetus and in the reproductive tract. And so it's, heifers that are pregnant do not ever perform to the same rate of gain or feed conversion as heifers that are intact but without calf. And so another topic that we've been, you know, has been brought up a lot is spaying heifers. So obviously the number of heifers that come up, well, all the heifers that come up from Mexico are spayed. They come across the border spayed. Okay. And we imported about 1 million head of feeder cattle from Mexico in the last year. And so there's a lot of cattle coming into the U.S. to be fed. And then also we are seeing more in the Wyoming area and some cattle being pulled across the border from Canada as spayed heifers. And so it is becoming a little bit more of a trend, obviously quite a process to get that done. One of the biggest advantages right now of spaying those females is that Experior, which is our newest spayed agonist on the market, Lubabagron, is not approved to be fed with MGA or melangestrol acetate.
Okay.
And so use MGA to suppress estrus and reduce those heifers from cycling in the feed yard or coming, you know, cycling is a big energy use, as many females are aware. And so just a little bit of historical thing on MGA, which I think a lot of people don't even, you know, realize this.
The men listening to this podcast are like, what? It takes.
We have no idea.
Yeah. Sorry, guys. Sorry.
So the biggest thing for this is so interesting to me when we talk about MGA, because you ask a producer, what is MGA used for? And they always say estrus suppression. And that's very true. That's on label. But what is also on label is improved rate of gain and feed conversion. Mm-hmm. And on average, a heifer that is fed MGA within the inclusion of the diet on label is going to gain about 19 additional pounds of hot carcass weight. That's a historical number. And so MGA... Tell how much suppressing estrus in a female in a heifer is going to improve her rate of gain and her overall hot carcass weight performance. And a lot of guys overlook that. I can't even tell you how many times I've had a conversation with a producer on just feed MGA because you're going to have a performance improvement.
Yeah.
But because MGA and Experior right now are not approved to be fed together in the feed yard system, we are seeing more guys spaying their females so that they can feed Experior in those settings.
Okay.
Yeah. The spayed data is pretty old. I mean, it's from the late 80s and early 90s, and we really don't have a good understanding of spayed females, but there are more and more spayed females in the population in the U.S., but that number is very hard to determine right now.
Right.
And so, yeah, I would say obviously MGA is a big one for guys who are feeding heifers. MGA is big. Obviously, when you're feeding in mixed pens, it's not on label to feed MGA to steers. And so you have to remove it in those scenarios. So it's just something to think about.
So in that situation, we've got a mixed pen. You can't feed the MGA because of the no label use for steers for obvious reasons. But like you can read that. Did you call it Experior? That's the new growth promotant.
Yeah.
Feed additive.
Yeah, agonist, antagonist, yes.
Could you just use Experior in those mixed pens? Did I say that right? Experior?
Yep.
Okay, yeah. You just feed that in those pens in instead.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, if you're not feeding MGA, you could, yes.
Yeah, I just was trying to make sure I was tracking correctly.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, Experior is obviously a very interesting beta agonist that's pretty new on the market over the last few years. Elanco has been putting out a lot of new data on it. Some of their most recent data sees about 30 pounds of additional hot carcass weight gain with feeding Experior for 56 days at the end of the feeding period. So there's a lot of value to it. And so it's what is your operation going to do? But then a lot of guys do not want to lose the value of MGA in those intact females. So
yeah,
one option would be perhaps to spay that female and then feed Experior in that setting.
That's a good point. We run some grass cattle and we do currently implant and they run together. So we don't feed any MGA. Like we get our grass cattle in January. So obviously they're not grazing on really anything. So we're supplementing, but we don't feed the MGA because they're running together. So that's really interesting. I appreciate you sharing that about the Experior and just kind of that information. So anyway, go ahead.
No worries. I think one thing, so this will be my final point on heifer management. Obviously, you know, riding, if they're in heat, et cetera, is important to monitor. It's interesting because once MGA is removed from the diet, or let's say it gets missed from the diet for a few days, they'll immediately start cycling again. So it's a great way to synchronize your females, but we don't really want them synchronized in a feedlot setting.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, so that's an important point to touch on. Again, too, you know, when we talk about outcomes, carcass outcomes, you know, comparisons between steers and heifers. Steers, you're going to worry if you're going to long day feed, so increased days on feed, you know, you're going to worry about those heavier hot carcass weights. Rarely do we see them come into a yield grade 5 scenario where we're getting discounted for yield grade 5, sometimes yield grade 4s. Heifers, on the other hand, very rarely do they have a hot carcass weight discount. You know, obviously estrogen intact females, estrogen in their body is keeping their growth curve, you know, from making them as large as a steer, and they just are not able to get there to have that hot carcass weight discount, especially in a time like right now where even certified Angus beef has increased their hot carcass weight discount up to 1,100 pounds. And so a lot of the packers, because of how we're feeding cattle, there's a lot of incentive to feed longer days on feed, which I think we'll get into that a little bit here. But, you know, heifers, we don't often worry about them being heavy, hot carcass weights. Fours and fives, we do worry about. And so just because of the nature of a female, obviously an intact female puts on fat, more ability for fat deposition in her body, less for muscle. And so we do see those females heifers in the feed yard having more opportunity to get a discount on yield grade fours and fives. But then the opposite side of that is that marbling in those females is often better in comparison to steers. And so on the latest national beef quality audit, heifers and steers, so percent of prime from steers and heifers, heifers increased over steers by 1.8% in prime outcome.
That's impressive. That's good to know. Yeah. Well, I would love to keep talking about growth promotants because the way they relate to consumers and just that whole Pandora's box. But I know that you are very excited about talking about carcass transfer. And so I want to give you time to talk about that because we talked about that to our audience. We were talking off air before the episode started and she just like lit up when I mentioned this. So I want to make sure that you have a chance to talk about it. I am not really familiar with carcass transfer. It really piqued my interest. So I'm just hoping you can explain that, what it means, its relevancy. I know that you were speaking about a paper that's being picked up that you authored. So let's just kind of delve into that.
Yes. So carcass transfer in the most easiest of terms would be the pounds of live game that are actually ending up on the carcass. So pounds of live game that are making their way onto the carcass of that animal. So in a time like right now, where we are drastically being paid for additional pounds of beef, we see historically high cattle prices. And just for, you know, today's sake, I actually pulled the National Weekly Cattle and Beef Summary for the week of May 6th. And so obviously a few days ago, live steers were coming in at $185.74 and dressed steers were at $294.65 per hundredweight. So we are seeing, like, it's crazy how valuable each additional pound of gain is on that animal. And so when we talk about carcass transfer, we really see, so some will often associate that with dressing percentage, right? The amount of carcass that's coming, or that weight of the carcass that's coming off of the live animal. But when we truly talk about carcass transfer, we can relate that back to the feeding period. And so as we are feeding for longer days on feed or extended days on feed past, like, let's say about 1,200 pounds in that animal, we will see this carcass transfer start to increase, which, I mean, can get up to about 88%. Common dressing percent in the United States is 64%. Mm-hmm. We take that number because it's the average dressing percent over that animal's feeding period. Average feeding period in the U.S. for steers right now is about 200 days on feed. That's come up a long way. Average for heifers is around 190. It's increased.
A lot, yeah.
And so the question that we were getting a lot about a year and a half ago when we were, you know, seeing this, okay, that the gap of, or the number of feeder cattle is going to tighten. Packers are going to need additional pounds on every animal that they put on the rail. How long do we feed for? And the stigma around long day feeding was that cattle would completely fall off in terms of average daily gain and feed conversion. Yes, those do decline. There's no doubt about it. And I'll, you know, send the viewers or the listeners over to Galleon's paper in 2023. He did a 6 and 7 study summaries of Merck animal health data, phenomenal serial slaughter data, and actually did regressions on those so that we can see the slopes of every additional day on feed. This is how dry matter intake changes, average daily gain changes, and feed conversion. So definitely go check out that paper for some really good regressions. So it's very obvious that feed conversion reduces, average daily gain reduces. But then when we look at hog carcass weight, it just increases. It continuously increases. And so a lot of our serial slaughter studies in the U.S. are done on a 42. So they'll do like 21 additional days on feed, 42 additional days. And that means that you're harvesting groups of cattle at those different days so that you can determine what carcass transfer was like and then put values back, live performance values, on a carcass adjusted basis. So live average daily gain and live feed conversion are going to look different from carcass average daily gain and carcass feed conversion, especially when we increase days on feed or feed longer in the feeding period. And so one of the biggest advantages is that as we feed for longer, hog carcass weight is obviously increasing. We're getting paid for hog carcass weight. And oh, by the way, right now, I think the number came out a couple of weeks ago or last week, for the first 4 weeks of April, or for the 4 weeks of April, steers were up 25 pounds in hot carcass weight year over year, and heifers were up 21 pounds in hot carcass weight.
Wow.
So Brandy, what does that tell you? We're feeding them way longer.
Oh yeah. They're on feed longer. I mean, it just makes sense too.
Yes, exactly. It makes sense. Right. And so, you know, especially when we talk about what the Choice Select Spread is doing, and I don't know if you pay attention to the National Weekly Summaries and et cetera. I often find myself reading them daily, but
no, I don't read those very often. No, I don't.
Yeah. So the Choice Select Spread right now, and it's been a hot topic, but it's come down for the week of May 8th. It was 8.42. So this is, you know, the spread that we see in box beef between choice and select carcasses. That is astronomically low compared to a year ago today and the 5 year average. Like, I mean, it's,
absolutely.
On average from 2023 on that same month was around $22 spread. Woo. So it's come down drastically, which tells you that the packer just wants to accept cattle because they need additional cattle in on the rail.
They just need beef. Yeah.
But we feed, when that choice select spread gets really high, it means, hey, feed for longer, make sure that your cattle are hitting a choice quality grade, because as you increase days on feed, we also see that increase in quality grade.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, Brownie, you mentioned I have, well, University of Nebraska, we had some serial slaughter data done that was completed in 2014. And as, you know, some universities, you know, that student moves on before it's published, and it was published in our beef report. So this has been in, you know, public press essentially for 10 years. Yeah. You know, and so all of our research trials that we do here at Nebraska do get published in our Nebraska beef report.
Okay.
And the study was done 10 years ago, and I undertook it over the last year to make it published. And it just got accepted into the Journal of Translational Animal Science. So it's exciting to have it finally published. It was individual animal feeding. So we used a GrowSafe system out at North Platte feeding facility. Gotcha. So it's interesting to have, you know, that dry matter intake data on an individual basis. But what I found the most interesting was, yes, hot carcass weight now, 10 years later, is astronomically higher than what the hot carcass weight was in this paper. But yeah, what's super interesting is that even with long day feeding, and in this paper, the long day feeding was like 180 days. That's like that's a short day feeding for us now. But the back fat thickness in this study was almost identical to the back fat thickness reported in the long day feeding trial that came out of West Texas A&M in 2023. Mm-hmm. And so it's so interesting because genetics, genetic improvements in our ability to use beta agonists and growth promoting technologies, we've increased hot carcass weight at such a drastic rate. Quality grade has improved. But, you know, our back fat thickness in this study was very, very similar across the board. And so it just shows like the change in technologies and the way that we feed cattle, essentially, and the type of cattle that we're feeding in terms of genetic ability. So it's very interesting. You know, that being said, though, we also have much fatter cattle in our population now today when you look at the National Beef Quality Audit in terms of yield grades, fours and fives. Those are a lot higher than they were 10 years ago for the National Beef Quality Audit. And so
I find it interesting because, like, when you're in, you know, you're in the, I don't know the right phrase to use, but you're like in the thick of it. You're feeding cattle, taking care of cattle, whether you're in a feedlot, cow, calf, stock, or whatever. Like, you don't notice those changes, those small incremental changes from month to month. But as you're speaking about, like, looking at this span of like 10 years, and it's just so shocking to see that change that happens over a decade. When it's happening, you don't really realize it. Mm-hmm. When you step back and look at it, like, it really is it's a big, big change.
Yeah, right. Like, that on average over the last 60 years, we've increased hot carcass weight in steers by about 4.5 pounds every year, and steers maybe 4 pounds every year, and heifers 4.5 pounds heavier on the heifers. And it's crazy because, yeah, when you're looking at a 2-year closeouts, comparing 2 years, you're like, oh, it's 4 pounds. And then you look at 60 years and it's like, oh, wow, here we go. 300 pounds. Yeah. It's, yeah. 240 pounds. Yeah, it's crazy.
It compounds quickly relative to, you know, a big time period. So I know that we've talked like in depth here about like feedlots here, but I also know that like you are an extension specialist. So you work with producers, you're working with feedlots out, you're like out in the feedlots with people. So when it comes to producers who are either maybe are retaining ownership or are trying to, you know, capitalize on their profitability with marketing cattle to a feed yard, if you could give producers like a piece of advice as it pertains to preparing their cattle for a feed yard, or even if they decide to retain ownership, like, I guess those are two different situations, but, you know, what piece of advice can you give those people?
Yeah. So I think number one, don't ever overlook a suckling calf implant. I've been having this conversation in a lot of detail over the last year, and, you know, I think the number is on average about 20% of cow-calf producers give a suckling calf implant. That implant, well, Ralgrow, for example, and there's other suckling calf implants, but I'm just going to give you Ralgrow as an example. 50 years old, and in the time that Ralgrow has been studied over those 50 years, on average, always a 23 to 26 pound weight gain for a calf that's given an implant that costs less than $2.
Oh.
So, and, you know, and then I get asked the question about, well, what about the new, you know, yeah, we're right. It's the lowest hanging fruit. Like, just give a suckling calf implant.
Absolutely.
If you're not marketing your cattle in an NHTC or all natural program, right? But I have, but that would suggest that 80% of our cattle feed, or that of our calf crop, our calf feds, are being marketed into all natural or NHTC program. And we know that that is not true. It's a niche market. And right, so my biggest comment is use a suckling calf implant. I don't care which one you use, but use one. And it's not an additional person at branding, et cetera. It's such a quick and easy process that literally you're giving a vaccination. Now you can give your implant as well. And I mean, there's a lot of literature and we can get into this in a lot of detail, Brandy, but for any of our consumers listening that maybe have questions on growth hormones and impact on beef, we see no residues transferring over into those beef animals. And when you look at the true difference between 4 ounces of soybean and 4 ounces of beef, it's the nanograms increase about 220,000 for a 4 ounce soybeans versus 4 ounces of beef. And the difference between implanted beef and non-implanted beef is the difference of about 1 nanogram of hormone, circulating hormone. And so it's very safe. It's uptaken by the animal and it's a repartitioning agent. So it repartitions energy from fat into muscle tissue, and that muscle tissue is beef. And so there's a lot of opportunity. So I would say use a suckling calf implant and don't ever forget your best management practices. I think that a lot of our, well, not a lot, I'm not going to say that, but I think that when we saw astronomically high cattle prices in the last year, guys wanted to capitalize on that. If the market was the highest that it had ever been for 4-weight calves or 5-weight calves, they were getting rid of them. They weren't doing their best management practices. They weren't weaning. They weren't, you know, maybe in some scenarios, they weren't even giving vaccines. You know, they weren't doing the regular best management protocols that they knew. Yeah. They just wanted to capitalize on it. And at a time when every pound is worth like over $3, why would you not be, why are you not doing your best management practices? And I think that that's just a point that I want to make for everybody in the cattle feeding world and in the cow-calf world. Your best management practices are going to favor you when prices are high and when prices are low. So don't ever forget about those. So, you know, pre-weaning protocols, we have some really interesting data on calf feds. And, you know, every time that we see some type of weaning protocol go with those calves, let's say they're not weaned on the truck before they head to a feed yard, the calf fed performance is improved in terms of rate of gain and feed conversion.
You kind of hit the nail right on the head there. Like, best management practices are best management practices for a reason, right? Like, they're not just throwing a dart throwing spaghetti at the wall and see if it sticks. You know, they're best management's for a reason. Yes. Just, you kind of cut out again at the beginning, so I just want to make sure that the audience can hear. She said at the very beginning, the piece of advice is a suckling calf implant. And so I just want to make sure that our audience heard that a suckling calf implant was like 26 or 28 pounds of additional growth.
23 to 26 pounds.
Yeah, 23 to 26 pounds of
additional. Conservatively, we can call it 20 pounds even, right?
There you go.
20 pounds for $2 is worth it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, why wouldn't you do that? So I think that's great, great advice. And you're right, we do see a lot of people, you know, just for lack of a better phrase, I'm just going to say strip them and ship them because they've seen these. I've worked in the breed industry world. And so we see that, but you're right. You're like, are you leaving money on the table by not adopting those best management practices? And then you mentioned the growth promotants and like consumers. I honestly don't know what the consumer listening numbers of this podcast are. However, I do know, even within our own beef community of beef producers and stuff like that, there are some people who really have some trepidation and skepticism about growth promotants. And some of our biggest critics of growth promotants are in the beef industry. So I think it's important what you said there, like the difference between a 3 ounce serving of implanted beef and a 3 ounce serving of non-implanted beef is like a difference, I think you said, of like 1.5 nanograms or something like that for our audience. A nanogram is like a decimal and then like 8 zeros and then a number. So a nanogram is like, it's nothing. So it may not be, I may have the number of zeros wrong, but it's not very big. So I just think I'm really glad you reiterated that. That's really important. You and I could have a very fun, interesting conversation in another episode, perhaps, about consumer trends and talking about, you know, how to communicate with them about beef production practices, things like that. So those were all really, really great points. Thanks for making those. Mm-hmm.
It's time for our famous three.
To wrap up with this, we're coming in on the end of the episode here, but just to wrap up, I ask all of our guests the same questions. And I gave you a heads up on these so that you wouldn't be, hopefully you weren't blindsided, but we asked the same three questions of every guest. And the first of those is, what is your favorite beef or cattle related book or resource? It doesn't have to be a book. I have had a couple people say it was a certain person. So fire when ready.
This is spoken like a true recent graduate of a PhD in feedlot nutrition, but the nutrient requirements of beef cattle. That's one of my faves. I use that as a resource often. But I also do want to shed light on a few other really good websites or newsletters that I subscribe to. So UNL, we have our Beef Watch, which is an extension-based newsletter, essentially. So you just go to beefwatch@unl.edu. And then I also want to shed light on Cow-Calf Corner, which comes from Oklahoma State University. Dr. Daryl Peel's segment is always my favorite on there. And he does a great recap of what's going on in the markets, what we're seeing in terms of cattle on feed numbers, et cetera. So I would definitely say Beef Watch and Cow-Calf Corner are two of my favorites.
Well, I have put those in our show notes. So if anybody wants to, those will be in the show notes. If you're listening to the episode, you can go and sign up for those and listen to those. So those are great resources. I often read Dr. Peel's columns throughout the month too, as well. I actually just read one about how much beef exports and imports the other day. So it's always good information from him.
Yeah, wasn't that one interesting?
Yes. Yes.
I know. That one was very interesting.
Yeah. Okay, so moving on, what is a book not related to the beef industry that you are currently reading? Or if you were like me and you're like bounced to three or four different books at a time, what is a favorite book that you have?
So Atomic Habits by James Clear. Okay. I'm working my way through it right now and I really like that book. And I think too, for, you know, as a graduate student, any graduate students listening, they're like, yeah, we don't read anything other than literature. Yeah. But I think there is a lot of value in reading something that can actually like relax your mind, but also improve you in other ways outside of just your professional understanding of animal science. So highly recommend.
I agree. I read a lot more in college, honestly, and grad school than I do now, to be completely honest. So grad school is maybe the best time to read because you maybe don't have a family or a cow herd or a full-time job. So just throwing that out there, grad students, so your life is probably not going to get less busy as you move on from here. So, and then our last one is, what is, when you think of someone that you look up to or admire, what is a trait that they have that has enabled them to be successful?
Yeah. So I would say, I need two words for this. I would say persistent in pursuing their goals, making sure that things get done and doing the things when they say they're going to do the things. But then also being empathetic. So, you know, that empathy to me is huge, and you don't know what people are going through daily. And so just being, trying to put yourselves in their shoes. And I mean, graduate student advisors have to do this often. But it's very important to be empathetic and just treat people with kindness. And some of my biggest mentors to me are relentless in the pursuit of their goals and dreams, but they also are very empathetic and they leave a lasting impact on everybody that they engage with. And so
I think that's so important. And I'm not going to make a broad sweeping statement about empathy and things like that, but I think that, I just think you hit the nail so squarely on the head there. And I'm going to sum it up in two words, and basically accountability and empathy. And I think that, I mean, I wholeheartedly agree with you. Those are such valuable assets or like characteristics that are kind of like intangible. Now, you know, like you don't realize it's not, like empathy is hard to measure. You know, it's not like a plaque you can hang on the wall or something like that. It's not an achievement. It's like a self-development journey, but like, I so respect and appreciate people, particularly in the professional world, who are empathetic. And I don't think that that can be, I don't think that can be valued enough. And then accountability, like they teach, what do they teach us that in like elementary school? Like if you say you're going to do something, do it, you know, like that's one of those, it's right up there with the golden rule for me. So those are fabulous traits. I wholeheartedly agree with those. So I'm glad to hear those. Unfortunately, that is all the time we have for today. Like I said, I could talk with you for another hour or so just about some of these things that we both share passions about, but I want to thank you for joining us here on the Beef Podcast. If people want to learn more about you or your work or your research or get in touch with you, like this is kind of your chance to plug that. If there's a social media profile you want to send them to or LinkedIn or something like that, you know, go ahead and share that.
Yes. So my LinkedIn is just my name, Jessica Sperber. I post quite a bit on there. So it would be great to have engagement and any questions. But also we have, I run the Instagram and Facebook page for UNL Feedlot Extension. Okay. And we've been putting out, in my opinion, some really good reels and content on feedlot related things. So yeah, follow along at UNL Feedlot Extension.
I will. So I put that in the show notes, and as soon as we get off this call, I will have to go check that out and follow those. I'm very interested. Reels are really hard to do for like a company or a business or something like that. Like they're hard to do when it's just your.
Yeah, I'm not just getting on there videoing myself. You know what I mean? Okay.
It's an additional level of work because it has to be, it's very niche and you need the footage and things like that. So I am excited to go and check those out and maybe copy some of your creativity. So thank you for sharing that with us.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, again, thank you so much, Dr. Sperber, for being on the podcast with us. I hope that that you have found this valuable and hopefully maybe we'll get you back on at another time to talk some more about some more topics since we have lots to cover more. So to our audience, thank you for joining us this week on the Beef Podcast. We hope that you'll join us next week wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.